Hello, you're listening to CJLO News. Montreal is facing extreme heat. Temperatures on Monday, June 23rd, reached 46 degrees with the Humidex. Environment and Climate Change Canada issued a heat warning, and the Quebec Health Ministry advised people to stay cool and hydrated to avoid heat-related illness. One Concordian professor, Dr. Lengzhu Leon Wang, is warning that those in denser, low-income areas with older buildings are particularly vulnerable during extreme weather.
I mean, those regions and buildings we call vulnerable buildings or communities in the context of heat waves.
Wang is the associate director for the Center for Zero Energy Building Studies. His research focuses on making buildings more resilient to extreme weather events like heat waves. Wang explains that areas like Rosemont, Park Extension, and here in Côte de Neige, where older buildings are grouped closer together, absorb more heat and create risks for residents.
In the past few years, we've been collecting data across Montreal, including schools, long-term care homes, hospitals, and social housing.
Wang is advocating that municipal and national building codes account for more extreme heat, with factors like better insulation, retrofits, and cooling systems.
We need more efforts and investment, right? To, I think, at least from government or municipality, so that we can have a better buildings and community, and in terms of policy making and developing policy, we can help the, in particular, low-income communities to retrofit their building. And also on the community level, provide emergency services, like say, if the building is not ready for heat waves, in the community level, can we provide some guidance or support, like we call probably some local cooling services.
He suggests that with climate change increasing the frequency of extreme weather events, these considerations are vital for health and safety. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
They shot a movie once in my hometown. Everybody was in it for miles around. Out at the speedway, some kind of Elvis thing. Well, I ain't no movie star, but I can get behind anything. Yeah, I can get behind anything. Get it out, get it all out. Yeah, stretch that thing. Make it last, make it last. Least till the shop bell rings. Well, taxi driver, life till the rhythm.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Tommy John Show here on CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hope everyone is doing well. Man, it's a hot one today on a Monday here in Montreal. What a show we have for you guys today. If you're new to the program, this is the Tommy John Show, where we discuss everything going on in the world of sports. We got to recap the Wimbledon finals over the weekend between the men, Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner. We'll get into that. And the women, Iga Swiatek and the American Amanda Anisimova. We will get into that. The MLB All-Star Game is tomorrow night. The Home Run Derby tonight. We will get into all of that. Big news in the NFL. We're dealing with the 49ers and one of their star players. We'll get into that. And the final major of the year, the British Open, the Open Championship, whatever you want to call it, takes place this week. Thursday through Sunday, the final major of the year. Can't believe it's already July and there will be no more majors thanks to that switch of the PGA to May a few years ago. We'll get into that at Royal Port Rush, the Open Championship. So we'll preview that as well. So we got a jam-packed show for you guys today. And if you are new to the program, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, you name it. The Tommy John Show is on it. And let's get this thing rolling with the Wimbledon final. We'll talk about the men first because it featured the two big names in the sport right now. Nothing against Djokovic. He's at the end of his career. It is Alcaraz and Sinner. That is what's driving the sport right now in men's tennis. It was Nadal and Federer 10, 15 years ago. Then you had Djokovic show up and it was the big three. And tennis was kind of looking for this new rivalry and they got it with these two young guys. They're only, what, 22 and 23 years of age? And they are by far the two best players in the world. It is not close. They were in the finals in that epic at Roland Garros when Alcaraz saved the three match points in the fourth set, ended up winning there. And then Jannik Sinner getting the better of him yesterday. And what a story for Jannik Sinner. Here's a guy who destroys everyone in the sport, whether you're Djokovic, whether you're Taylor Fritz, Jack Draper, Zverev, Rude, Holger Rune, whoever you are in the sport, you cannot get past Jannik Sinner. You can't do it. Sinner is just automatic. He does not lose to anyone not named Carlos Alcaraz. Over the last 2 years, I don't know what happened to Jannik Sinner when he played Carlos Alcaraz. Maybe it was Alcaraz's speed and his shot making. He could not, for the life of him, beat him. I don't know what it was. He lost to him. We remember at that crazy U.S. Open quarterfinals a few years ago, a thriller. He lost that one. He lost to Indian Wells last year. He lost the semis of the French Open to him last year. Lost the finals in Beijing to him. At home, at the Italian Open in Rome, he loses to him this year. Then, just when you think he's going to get over the line at the French Open, Alcaraz saves three match points, forfs a fifth set, and wins that in a tiebreak to rip Sinner's heart out. He just could not get over the line. He couldn't do it. And yesterday, he finally did it. He took down Carlos Alcaraz in four sets. And when he lost that first set, because let's be honest, he outplayed Alcaraz in the first set, in my opinion. He was serving it better. Alcaraz was being a bit sloppy. And then Alcaraz just kicked it into another gear the last four games. He was down 4-2 in that opening set, and he just completely took it over after that. And I honestly thought then, oh my God, like Alcaraz is going to get this done rather quickly here now. He's into the match, and he just blew through him. And the real turning point for me was the first game of the second set. It was 5-4 Alcaraz, Sinner serving. They were on serve. And he broke him to win the first set. Alcaraz then gets to start the second set on his serve. And he played an incredibly sloppy game. Sinner broke him. And Sinner just held on and won the set. And it was even after that. That was a very sloppy game. Alcaraz had no momentum. He was yelling at his box. That was a huge moment in that match. If Alcaraz holds serve there, gets the 1-0 lead, continues to push the pedal down, that would have been five games in a row. To me, that, not saying he doesn't win the match, but it becomes a different story. Maybe we get a five-setter because Alcaraz really put all the momentum, had all the momentum, just to give it away with a sloppy, sloppy game. To me, was a big turning point and helped Sinner get over the line. And also, listen, I thought on grass it suited Alcaraz more, despite Sinner winning the only meeting in majors at Wimbledon a few years ago, but that was before Alcaraz was really Alcaraz. He's won two Wimbledons in a row, just one in Queens. Sinner was very fortunate with that Dimitrov match in the round of 16. He didn't win a set. Dimitrov won the first two sets, and then they're two apiece in the third set, and his pec blows out, and Dimitrov had to pull out. So that was a huge moment for Jannik Sinner, because he was not out of it by any means, because he's a much better player than Grigor Dimitrov, but he was in a serious, serious hole in that round of 16 match, and he found a way by just I don't want to say luck, but just from unfortunate circumstances to get through that match. And he took that break and he ran with it. He played very well against Ben Shelton. And I understand Djokovic was compromised. He was pretty much on one leg. But still, the win against Djokovic on center court, straight sets, was very impressive. But to me, I just thought the head-to-head matchup, he mentally, what happened a month ago, I thought Alcaraz would probably win. But Sinner, to his credit, on this surface, is going to be very tough to beat, because he is serving the lights out at the minute. He was unbelievable on his serve. And it got iffy there, though, in the fourth set. That was a big, big moment for Jannik Sinner. He's serving at, 4-3 up a break in the fourth set, up 2-1. And Alcaraz got it to 15-40. And we all remember what happened in the fourth set a month ago in Paris, when Sinner had the 3 match points, then had a chance to serve it out on his serve, and he lost it. If something similar happened there, if Alcaraz gets the break in the fourth, who knows? Who knows? Because then Sinner's head would be spinning. Oh my God, is this going to happen again? But to his credit, he served brilliantly the rest of that game. And then in that final game, he lost the first point, I believe, and then he settled in quite nicely after that. Jannik Sinner, what a match for him. And Carlos Alcaraz, very gracious in defeat. He said, hey, listen, you know, you do deserve this. And basically saying they have a close relationship. They grew up playing boys and juniors together. So they're very close, despite this being quite the rivalry. They're by far the two best players in the world. And I feel like Alcaraz maybe took this one better because of what happened a month ago in Paris, the way he just ripped his heart out. And he's already won the tournament twice. But obviously he wanted to win that, not saying he didn't. But he was very, very happy for Jannik Sinner, and he was very gracious in defeat. And Jannik Sinner, always a great sport, was very gracious as well. But we got a rivalry now. We got a true rivalry in the sport. And the main question, I think, now, after this Wimbledon, and now after these 2 years where these guys have just dominated the majors. Last year, Sinner won 2 majors. Alcaraz won 2 majors. So far, Sinner has 2 majors. Alcaraz is the other one. Alcaraz has 5 majors. Sinner has 4. These are the 2 best players in the world. Not even close. There's a Grand Canyon, an ocean between them. And then you would probably say Djokovic at this stage is the 3rd best player. He got to the semis in Australia, got to the semis at the French, got to the semis here at Wimbledon, despite being injured. I would say he's still the 3rd best player in the world. But there's just a huge gap. And then after Djokovic, there might be a bigger gap. Who is it? Is it Ben Shelton? Is it Fritz? Is it Jack Draper? Is it Holger Rune? Who is the Zverev? Who would you say is the 4th best player in the world? There's no one really that stands out to me. Shelton might be playing the best in the majors, but I wouldn't put him anywhere near the Djokovic level. So to me, it goes Sinner, Alcaraz, Alcaraz, Sinner. Yeah, pick your poison. Right this year, you would have to say Sinner. He has 2 majors. But it is very close. They're neck and neck. It's anyone's day is who's the best player in the world. And then the huge gap, then Djokovic, then an even bigger gap to the 4 through 10 best players in the world. That's where we stand in tennis. And the main question is who's going to be the 3rd guy to join them? Or is there going to be a guy to join them? It was 10 years, 15 years ago. Maybe 20 years ago now, 15 years ago, when it was Federer, the best player in the world, and then Nadal, and that was the rivalry. And then, oh, here comes this kid from Serbia named Novak Djokovic, and he was the 3rd guy. And then they had their surrounding characters, too. They had the Andy Murrays. They had the Stan Wawrinkas. They had the Marin Ciliches, the Thomas Berdych lights. So who's going to be the next guy? Is it going to be this Brazilian kid, Fonseca? He's 18 years of age. He's a phenom. Will he be the young guy that joins them in 2 or 3 years to make a strong top three? Because right now, it's who's going to get to the semifinal? Because everyone knows who's going to be in the finals of these majors. And what's really interesting now is who completes the Grand Slam first. Because all Alcaraz has to win is the Australian Open. And all Sinner has to win is the French Open. And he pretty much did that a month ago. Had several chances. Well, we know he had 3 match points in the fourth set. But Alcaraz will get the first shot at it because the Australian Open, it comes our way in January, and we got to wait until next May for the French. But what a rivalry we have now in the sport, and this is giving tennis a ton of juice heading into the hard court season over in North America. We have, I believe, the women this year in Montreal. The men will be in Toronto. Then you have Cincinnati. And then the U.S. Open around Labor Day weekend. And, man, you get some night matches with these guys. It will be absolutely unbelievable. So, tennis has a lot of juice, especially on the male side, heading into the second half of the tennis season. We head to the women's, and, God, I was excited for that match, but it was over before I could even blink. That was one of the biggest smackdowns I've ever seen. Iga Świątek, who apparently couldn't play on grass, played pretty darn well her last two matches. She had to fight through some early matches. She won a three-setter in the second round against McNally. Had to dig deep there. And then after that, she pretty much cruised. She smoked Collins, got through Samsonova relatively easily. And then in the semifinal, she destroyed Bencic 6-2, 6-love, and then absolutely annihilated Anisimova yesterday. 6-love. It's the first time ever in a Wimbledon final that it finished 6-love, 6-love. And I think they mentioned on the broadcast the only other time was Steffi Graf in 88, the French Open final. She won 6-love, 6-love in like 30-something minutes. This one was done under an hour. What a performance. And she was really slipping at the end of last year for her standards. Didn't even win the French this year. She's pretty much like the female Nadal, always wins the French Open. She couldn't get that done this year. Hadn't won a title in over a year. And then she came into Wimbledon. She had a good tune-up on the grass tournaments, focused on the grass, had some time because she was bounced in the semis at the French to really prepare for the grass court season. And did she ever make that work pay off, because she was unbelievable at Wimbledon this week. And now you look at her, she is really set up to have a good second half of the year. To me, she's a very streaky player. When it's bad, it's very bad. But when she's on, my goodness, she takes a player like Anisimova and another player like Bencic and just destroy them. Like, that was not even a tennis match in those semifinal and final matchups. And now she has 6 major titles, 4 French Opens, a U.S. Open from 2022, and now a Wimbledon championship. And like Alcaraz, all she needs is an Australian Open to complete the career Grand Slam. And she's only 24 years of age. That's the crazy thing about all these guys and women. 24 years of age for Świątek. Sinner's 23. Alcaraz is 22. This young crop of players is truly, truly staggering. They are unbelievable, and they just keep on getting better. But I felt for that Amanda Anisimova. She played unbelievable in that semifinal against Sabalenka to get through that one. She played very well early in the year, winning that Qatar event, the WTA 1000. She's played very well all year, turned her career around, but to lose 6-love, 6-love, my God, that is one way to lose a major final. Now, this can go one of two ways. It's either going to just spiral her out of control and we don't hear from her for a while, or she's going to use this as motivation to get ready for the second half of the year. It's going to North America. It's going to the hard court. She, like we mentioned, won a hard court event earlier in the year. Hits the crap out of the ball. She should play well in the second half of the year, I believe. Now, this could mess with her mentally, because that is a lot to take in. You get to a major final, you're so excited, and to lose in under an hour and not even win a game. that could really, really mess with you. So it's going to be interesting to see. I want her to do well. I felt bad for her that she had to do that post-match interview with the BBC, whoever, I believe it's the BBC on the court afterwards. I mean, she didn't even answer the girl's question. She just thanked her box and cried, understandably. Like, that's a brutal spot to be in. Not only do you lose a major final, to lose like that. I mean, I just would have just, hey, go to the locker room. I understand it's Wimbledon. They have the rules. You have to answer the questions. Fair enough. But that was not even, that reminded me a bit of Cilic when he lost to Federer, I think in 2017. Remember, he was crying in his chair. It was very similar, on Saturday afternoon with Amanda Anisimova. She just could not get anything going. And the emotions hit her. And she started to realize, my goodness, I'm about to lose Wimbledon final, not even win a game. And then the emotions take over, and understandably. But hopefully this makes her motivated to come back and maybe make a run at the U.S. Open. It's going to go one of two ways. It really is. I don't see her being, oh, get to a quarterfinal and lose. No. I see her either being out in the first few rounds of these next tournaments or her going on a serious run and knocking some of these tournaments off. Can she get it done in Montreal this year? Maybe Cincinnati? And look for her to make a run at the U.S. Open. I think this might ignite a fire under her. I really do. Like Sinner. I like, look at that. After that heartbreaking final, obviously he played his heart out and just lost the heartbreaker. Fair enough. But look at him. He got himself off the canvas, came back, won Wimbledon. Now Anisimova, it's the other end. You weren't close at all to winning. You didn't even win a game. But can you pick yourself off the canvas, get up, and try and make a run at some big tournaments now over the next few months? That's pretty much what it comes down to. So a very successful Wimbledon this year. I was highly entertained, especially throughout the first week of the tournament, because you had so many seeds losing. Like, you had Zverev lost early on. Jack Draper lost early on. Tsitsipas lost early on. Holger Rune. It was nuts. Every top 10 player, it felt like, outside of Djokovic, Alcaraz, Fritz, and Sinner, lost. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was crazy. You had, what's his name, lost as well. I'm drawing a blank on him right now. The two Canadians lost early on. Tommy Paul lost early on. It was nuts. And they were dropping like flies the first week of the tournament. And that really made it interesting to the second week, because you still had the big names, you still had the three big players, but everyone around them was losing. Like, oh my God, like, what's going on here? Zverev lost in the first round. I'm trying to think now. The other Holger Rune was the first round. That was the other one. Medvedev first round. And then you had the Holger Runes, the Jack Drapers, and all those guys falling in the second round. It was absolutely nuts. You had Coco Gauff losing in the first round after winning the French Open. Wimbledon, the first week, was just mayhem. The seeded players were just losing at will. Crazy. So a very successful Wimbledon. It's always my favorite tournament. I do love the U.S. Open as well. Just Labor Day weekend and the night matches. You can get a match that starts at 11 p.m. Just something about the U.S. Open at night in New York. It's right there with it. But Wimbledon, the tradition, everything, the all-whites playing on grass. You can't beat it. You can't beat it. So a very successful Wimbledon this year. And, yeah, this is giving tennis a ton of juice as we head to the second half of the year. But I will say this. I don't know what's going to happen on the men's side. Because I know Alcaraz and Sinner are going to be there, but who's going to be the other one? That is our main question that we can take away from today. Who's going to be the third player of this young crop to step up? Could it be Draper? He won Indian Wells. Or do we have to wait for this Fonseca kid from Brazil to really show up and lead the charge of just trying to compete with these two guys? Because if not, this could be the next, this could be the major finals for the next 3-4 years. That's how much better these guys are than the rest. Unbelievable. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a bit about the Open Championship, the final major of the year in golf. T. tees off on Thursday at Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland. We'll get into that, as well as talk a bit about Major League Baseball as we have the Home Run Derby and the All-Star Game this week. I'm Tommy Lane for the Tommy John Show. Back after this quick word from our sponsors. Do not go away.
The Festival International Nuit d'Afrique, presented by TD, invites you to the 39th edition for the best of world music, from July 8th to 20th. For 13 days, Montreal will be dancing and singing to the rhythms of Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. Full program and tickets on festivalnuitdafrique.com.
If you like... served with a side of a little bit of and a heaping helping of then you're gonna love BVST, your best and worst of rock and roll, country, punk and metal, every Wednesday from 7 to 9 right here on CJLO 1690 AM.
Back here in the Tommy John Show, a little Van Morrison from Northern Ireland, because Royal Portrush is hosting the Open Championship this week. The final major of the year, the Open Championship, and it's really a tough spot for golf, because when the PGA was moved to May and it allowed the players to move to March, people loved it. You're like, oh, we go into the Masters. Now we don't have to wait 2 months for a major. We got the PGA right after in May. It's great. But then once you get to the Open Championship now, people are like, oh, my God, this is the last major? We have to wait till April? Till the Masters? So that's the one bad thing. I'm in a tough spot because I love when the PGA's on in May. I do. I think it's great. I get my little golf fix for the month, watch the PGA Championship, and it's great. And I guess it opens more courses up, maybe because of the weather. Because if you play in Texas or in Oklahoma or Arizona in August, oh my God. But still, to me, the PGA ideally would be in August. But I understand... they're trying to promote the hell out of this FedEx Cup playoffs, which has no juice. It did a few years ago, but now they did like the weird point system where people started different numbers under par. That made it a bit gimmicky. But like up to like 2019, maybe 2018, like the FedEx Cup, like the Tour Championship was meant something. Now they're making the changes this year. We'll see if it's better. Fair enough. But they're trying to just promote the hell out of FedEx Cup playoffs. And I understand it's a season-long race that you're trying to get in. It means you get into more tournaments. Fair enough. I'll watch. I'm not saying I won't. But I'm a golf nut. But the average fan, the casual golf fan, there's not much juice to the tour, to the FedEx Cup playoffs. Maybe the back nine of the Tour Championship, if it's on the line, you say, oh man, like there's a big name, Scheffler and Rory are going out. All right, I'll turn the TV on. But for golf, the next big thing after this will be the Ryder Cup. They're promoting the hell out of it, rightfully so. The Americans got their butts kicked in Europe, and now they're like, oh, but it's on home soil now. It's at Bethpage Black in New York, the home fans. There's a ton of juice for the Ryder Cup this year. That's what NBC's promoting like hell, even more in the Tour Championship, which is hard to believe. That's why they moved the PGA to August. All right, to May. Fair enough. But to me, having the last major of the year be in July, when summer started a few weeks ago, is crazy. Like, to me, it was fine the way it was. I don't mind keeping the Players in March. I like the Players being the first big event of the year, leads you right into the Masters. To me, I like that. Keep that there. Move the damn PGA to August. You can make it late July, early August. I don't care. Move it to August. And then start your FedEx Cup playoffs. Why not? I don't understand. Like, to me, they're putting so much love and interest into this FedEx Cup playoffs. Okay, it's fine. It's nothing amazing. It's cool when you win the FedEx Cup, but I don't care about, like, the BMW Championship or the one they play in Memphis, the St. Jude, FedEx St. Jude. All right, like, fine. Those are cool tournaments. It doesn't move the needle. The PGA Championship, despite it being the, I don't want to say the worst major, but the least respected major, is still a major championship. So to have that in August to cap off the year, to me, would be better. And I understand it cuts the venues down if you do that. I don't care. We got some unbelievable golf courses in the Northeast and in the Northwest that can host those majors. We're in the South all the time. They're in Florida all the time. They're in California all the time. Come on. We got great golf courses in the Northeast that you can use. I know they had it at Oak Hill in May a few years ago. Yeah, sure, that's great. Oak Hill can host it in August. Why can't we go to the Midwest in August? We can do all those things. We don't need a PGA championship in Frisco, Texas. We don't need that. They have plenty of PGA Tour events. They have the Byron Nelson there. They have San Antonio. They have all the Houston. They have all these tournaments. Like, come on. There's not a whole lot of golf tournaments in the Northeast. You have the U.S. Open once in a while come there, and, like, that's it. And the Northeast, like, New York is maybe the state for country club golf courses. You have Wingfoot, you have Shinnecock, you have National Golf Links of America. Like, it's unbelievable the amount of golf courses the New York, New Jersey area has. New England has some unbelievable golf courses. We saw the country club host the U.S. Open a few years ago. I used to go to TPC Boston. There is some great, great golf courses in the Northeast that you can use as PGA Championship venues. PGA Frisco, I mean, oh my God, that is no juice whatsoever. And that's what's hurt the PGA Championship over the years. They just pick these venues that have no juice. And when they do pick venues that have juice, you know, you get a good rating. When the PGA was at Oak Hill, it got a good rating. You know, a Quail Hollow, okay, is a cool course, but we see Quail Hollow every year. Well, we want a tournament with some juice. We want a major with some juice. And the course, honestly, has something to do with that. I think that was what hurt LIV. They're playing at these courses that no one can relate to, that they can shoot 30 under par. The PGA Tour, they still have Pebble Beach. They still have Riviera. They still have Sawgrass. They still have Bay Hill. They have the venues. And that helps. Pebble Beach did a monster rating this year. Know why? A, it's Pebble Beach, and B, you had a good leaderboard. But mostly, hey, I want to watch Pebble Beach this week. Trust me, it plays a factor. And the PGA Championship, moving it to May, okay, it's great when it's here because that gap between the U.S. Open and the Masters is closed. But then you get to the Open Championship this week, and you're like, my God, this is the last major. To me, it would just be better off just push the FedEx Cup playoffs back a little bit. I understand they don't want to go head-to-head with the NFL, and that's another big problem for them. Is they keep pushing it back. Okay, then we're in the football season and no one's going to watch us. I understand that part. But to me, it's just nuts that the last major of the year is done in mid-August. That's the crazy part. Mid-July, sorry. So if we look at the golf course itself, Royal Portrush, sorry for that little rant about the moves and moving the PGA and this being the last major. It is unbelievable. It's ranked in the top five outside of the U.S., I believe. I think Northern Ireland has two of them. They have Royal County Down, which is number one or number two outside the U.S., and Royal Portrush. And it hosted in 2019, and it was a huge success. The crowds were unbelievable when Shane Lowry won. And this is an unbelievable golf course. It is unbelievable. The greens are just brutal. A lot of slope in them. The views are spectacular. It's literally at the northernmost point of Northern Ireland. And it's a great links golf course. And what I'm going to love about this major is the storylines. Because you have Rory finally back in form. He finished in the top five or top six at the Travelers, his last start in the U.S. And then finished second this past weekend in Scotland at the Renaissance Club at the Scottish Open. So he's in good form, and he says he's in good form, and this is like a huge tournament for him in front of his home crowd. He needed something to get him going again after completing the career Grand Slam at Augusta. He said this is what the doctor ordered. He needed a tournament like this. An Open Championship in his backyard at a course he loves, where he has the course record as a 16-year-old. This is what Rory needed. And he thinks he's going to play pretty darn well this week. So you have the Rory angle. You have the Shane Lowry angle. He won here in 2019. How is he going to play? Is he going to find his form again? Is Scheffler going to continue this dominant run? And then you also have the Liv angle. And DeChambeau's always going to be a factor. He's always going to be in the headlines. But this is the one major that has kind of messed with him a bit. He's always been at the hunt at Augusta. He's been at the hunt at the PGA several times, especially last year at Valhalla. And this year, he was hanging around the leaderboard at Quail Hollow. And in the U.S. Open, he's won twice. He loves playing the U.S. Open. But the Open Championship's been the one that's messed with him, because he loves to just tee the ball up high and rip it and see where it goes. You do that at an Open Championship, you know, you're going to be in the fescue. It's so windy, the wind can take your high ball flight and just throw it wherever. And that's what it's been a big problem for Bryson DeChambeau. He has a hard time hitting those lower, kind of stingier shots that cut through the wind. And as a result, the wind just takes his iron shots and his drives and just throws them into the fescue. And we'll see if he's made the appropriate adjustments this week. I'm really excited to see how Bryson plays. To me, he is either going to be right in contention or he's going to be 80-78. He'll be back on a plane back to the U.S., to me. I have not seen him play well on these kind of courses. And maybe it's a week where the wind dies down and Bryson can fire at every flagstick and he's chilling. But it's usually not the case in Ireland and in Scotland. That usually does not happen. There's going to be some sort of wind, rain, some sort of elements you got to battle. So to me, Bryson has an outside chance, but not a great chance of competing right now for the Open Championship. Scottie Scheffler, listen, he played okay this past weekend in Scotland. Nothing spectacular, but he's definitely going to be in the mix. He's just always around the top 10, top 15. So to me, Scheffler will be in the mix. And another big storyline is Tommy Fleetwood, who loves to play in these conditions. Loves it. Loves playing links golf. Just had the heartbreak a month ago at the Travelers. Can he somehow find a way to compete and win a big tournament? He's won some DP World Tour events in Dubai and in other places, fair enough. But he has not won on the PGA Tour, has not won a major. Can he get over the line and win one of these big tournaments? To me, that was, I wonder how he's gonna respond. I know he played last weekend in Scotland, but to me, it's going to be very interesting after losing the Travelers to Keegan Bradley in the fashion that he did. Can he respond as well? Those are my big storylines. I do like Corey Connors this week. He's a good iron player. He can hit low shots. I think he can be in the mix. He's not he's not an amazing putter, but he, on links golf, you don't have to be. It's all about lag putting anyway. Obviously, it helps if you put the lights out, but you don't need to be rolling the rock like you need to be in contention at Augusta or at a U.S. Open. This is about lag putting, which Corey Connors can do. It's about ball striking, hitting fairways, hitting greens, and par being your friend. That is the goal this week, so I can see Corey Connors being up high up on the leaderboard come the weekend. So Rory, Shane Lowry, Scottie Scheffler, Bryson, and Tommy Fleetwood, to me, would be the big storylines. And the other one that I'm looking forward to is there an American who's going to step up and help this Ryder Cup team? Because right now, it's going to be Scheffler. It's going to be JT, Morikawa, Shoffley. Xander plays very well at the Open Championship, so he should probably be in the mix. He's the defending champion. But the American team right now for the Open Champ, for the Ryder Cup, is really lacking some juice. So is there going to be an American that comes out of nowhere that can compete at the Open Championship and give Keegan Bradley an easy pick in a month or two? When do they pick the team? In a month? I think in a month's time they have to pick the team. So is there an American? We saw J.J. Spahn do it. He's a lock to be on the team. Can someone else, one of these Americans, not the Justin Thomases or the Colin Morikawas, is there like a Maverick McNealy or someone like that who can come up the leaderboard and make some noise and make it an easy pick for Keegan Bradley to make the Ryder Cup team? We had this kid, Chris Goddard, who won the Scottish Open yesterday. He's 25 years of age. Does he play well at the Open now? Can he make the Ryder Cup team? Who knows? It's going to be very interesting for Keegan Bradley to see what's happening there. John Rahm should be interesting. A lot of people like him. He played well at the U.S. Open for a little bit. He obviously was in contention at Quail Hollow for the PGA. Really went for it on the green mile, and it bit him. But he was right there on the back nine until Scotty pulled away. His major form is definitely heading in the right direction. He won the Masters, obviously, a few years ago, won the U.S. Open all those years ago. But since he joined LIV that year, he was not competitive in any of the majors. To me, he should be a factor come the weekend. But it should be a great tournament. It's an unbelievable golf course. I would not be surprised. If we get a little Rory Scotty showdown on Sunday. To me, they're playing. Rory's back to playing close to his best that we saw earlier in the year when he won the Masters, when he won the Players, when he won at Pebble Beach. It looked very similar in Scotland and in the Travelers. To me, he's rounding in the form, so he should be up there on the leaderboard. Scottie Scheffler's always there, and who's going to challenge him? That's going to be a major question for them. So I cannot wait for that. The time's going to be weird. They're probably going to tee off at like 3 in the morning our time sometimes. But just record. You can skip through the commercials and stuff. That's what I do. And at least the weekend, it should be a bit better for the tee off times, around 9, 10 o'clock, I would assume, in the morning. So there we go. The Open Championship this week, and we'll recap it next Monday about who won the golf tournament and all that. Quickly in the baseball, and the Blue Jays went on an unbelievable run. They did lose their last two in Oakland, but they have a two-game lead now in the American League East as we head to the All-Star break over the New York Yankees, but they might have another threat in their division because the Boston Red Sox have won 10 in a row. They swept the Tampa Bay Rays in a four-game series at home this weekend. Not to mention they swept the Nationals and the Rockies. And I know when they won the six in a row, people were like, it was against the Nationals and the Rockies. Any team can do that. But to get Tampa Bay, who was playing better, they were over 500 coming into Boston. They were competing for those wild card spots. To take four games from them was very, very impressive. They got great pitching over the weekend. Crochet pitched a full game shutout and a 1-0 win on Saturday. And Bale was great yesterday. So the Red Sox, 10 in a row. They're 53-45 and are only three games back of the Blue Jays in the American League East. We quickly go to the Central, where the Detroit Tigers still remain the best team in the American League despite losing four in a row. The Tigers have not played well as of late, but they're still the best team in the American League, cruising atop of the Central. They had that rough series against the Mariners over the weekend. Cal Raleigh went nuts. All right, we understand it. It happens. But the Tigers still leading the Central by 11.5 games. 11.5. 11.5. They lose four in a row, and they're still up by 11.5. We won't talk about the rest of the Central because it is not a good place for Minnesota, Kansas City, Cleveland, and the White Sox. We go to the West, and the Houston Astros have a 5-game lead over the Seattle Mariners and an 8.5 game lead over the Texas Rangers. The Angels are hovering right around 500. They're 47 and 49. They're right around there. So they're not totally done yet with a half the season left to go. The American League is really, really nothing great. It's the American League East is by far the best division. You have the Blue Jays leading the way. The Yankees are the top wild card, followed by Boston, then Seattle. Then there's a 1.5 game gap between Seattle and Tampa Bay. 3.5 between them and the Texas Rangers. 4 between the Angels and the Twins. But to me right now, unless something crazy happens, our playoff teams are kind of set. You're going to get Toronto, New York, Boston. You're probably going to get Seattle. And the only other team maybe I can see is Tampa or Texas. Texas has so much talent on the roster, so maybe they turn it around in the second half. They won a World Series 2 years ago. Maybe they can get on a run. But I look at Cleveland, Baltimore, the A's, the White Sox, the Royals, the Angels, the Twins. Maybe Minnesota is the other team that could. But I look at the rest of those teams. I don't see any of them doing anything. To me, it's those teams, with the possible exception of Texas, Tampa, maybe Minnesota creeping in. But to me, I could easily see this being the same thing because no one else in the American League is impressing me right now. No one. We head to the National League, and it's a different story. There are a ton of teams competing. We'll quickly go to the National League East. The Phillies have a half-game lead over the New York Mets. The Miami Marlins are playing a tad better. Recently, they're 5-5 in their last 10, have won 2 in a row, but they're 10.5 back of the Phillies. And maybe the most surprising thing in baseball right now is the Atlanta Braves being 12.5 back. With that roster, with that amount of talent, they are 12.5 back. They got off to that brutal start to the year, and they really have not recovered. We go to the Central, and the Cubs are only 1 game up on the Milwaukee Brewers because the Brewers have won 7 in a row. And they're right on their tail, 1 game back. The St. Louis Cardinals are 6.5 back. The Cincinnati Reds are over 500 at 50-47. They are 7.5 games back of the Cubs. The West, it's still the Dodgers. They had that rough stretch in Milwaukee. They came back home, got settled against the Giants, have won 2 in a row. They have a 5.5 game lead over the Padres and a 6-game lead over the San Francisco Giants. The Diamondbacks 11 back, and we will not talk about the Colorado Rockies, who are 22-74. 22-74. They are 35.5 games back of the Dodgers, and we are at the All-Star break. So quickly to the wild card in the National League, the Brewers are the number one spot as the wild card, followed by the New York Mets, then the San Diego Padres. And the National League is far more of an interesting race. They're just way better teams. You have Cincinnati, you have St. Louis, you have San Diego, you have the Giants all over 500 competing for that last spot. But right now it's Milwaukee, the Mets, the Padres, then the Giants are a half game back, the Cardinals a game and a half back, the Reds 2.5 games back. But to me, Milwaukee should get in. It's going to be between Milwaukee and the Cubs. They're going to get in. The Mets or the Phillies are both going to get in. And then it's the real question is who's going to be that other team from the National League West that takes that spot. The Cardinals have kind of come back to earth a little bit. They're 4-6 in their last 10. To me, San Francisco and San Diego just have more talent, and one of them will take the last spot. Devers not playing great for the Giants, but I expect him to break out of that rut pretty soon. So we have the Home Run Derby tonight from Atlanta. Cal Raleigh, obviously the favorite. He has 38 home runs already for the Seattle Mariners this year. He's the favorite at plus 260 for tonight. O'Neill Cruz, James Wood, Matt Olson, Brent Rooker, Byron Buxton, Junior Caminero, and Jazz Chisholm, the other competitors in tonight's Home Run Derby. We'll quickly just walk through the starters in the National League and the American League for the All-Star game tonight, just if you care to know. Cal Raleigh, obviously a catcher for the Seattle Mariners. Unbelievable year so far. Toronto Blue Jay, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., he will start at first base. Gleyber Torres for the Tigers. Junior Caminero for the Tampa Bay Rays. Jacob Wilson for the Athletics. The outfield will go Aaron Judge for the Yankees, Riley Green for the Tigers, Javier Baez for the Tigers as well, and the DH will be Ryan O'Hearn for the Baltimore Orioles. And no surprise here, Tarek Skubal will get the ball in the first inning, the star pitcher for the Detroit Tigers. The other all-stars, if you want to know from the Blue Jays, are Alejandro Kirk. He had a great year as a catcher. He's the other one. And Alex Bregman from the Red Sox is the other one from the from the American League East. We head to the National League, and there's no surprises here. It's just half the Dodgers lineup. You have Will Smith from the Dodgers as the starting catcher. Freddie Freeman for the Dodgers as the starting first baseman. Then you have Ketel Marte, who's having an unbelievable year with the Diamondbacks. He's at second base. Manny Machado, he'll be at third base from the San Diego Padres. Francisco Lindor for the New York Mets at short. The outfield will go Ronald Acuna Jr. from the Braves, Pete Crow Armstrong from the Cubs, and Kyle Tucker from the Cubs, with Shohei Ohtani from the Dodgers DHing. And no surprises, Paul Skeens, the phenom from the Pittsburgh Pirates, will be the starting pitcher for the National League in the first inning. So that's the All-Star game tomorrow in Atlanta, the Home Run Derby tonight. So that's where we stand in Major League Baseball. The Blue Jays continue to be hot, and the Red Sox, look out for them. They've won 10 in a row. So we're going to take our second break. When we come back, we got big news from the NFL, and man, I did not expect to see that this close to training camp, with players already demanding certain deals, and more news on the Trey Hendrickson situation as well. I'm Tommy Lane for the Tommy John Show. We'll be back from after this quick word from our sponsors. Do not go away.
The Festival International Nuit d'Afrique, presented by TD, invites you to the 39th edition for the best of world music from July 8th to 20th. For 13 days, Montreal will be dancing and singing to the rhythms of Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. Full program and tickets on festivalnuitdafrique.com.
If you like served with a side of a little bit of and a heaping helping of then you're gonna love BVST, your best and worst of rock and roll, country, punk and metal, every Wednesday from 7 to 9 right here on CJLO 1690 AM.
Here on the Tommy John Show. So the NFL, it's getting closer. We are getting closer and closer to the NFL returning training camp, a few weeks away now. Yeah, and there's reports now that from several analysts that the Bengals trading Trey Hendrickson might be inevitable now. They cannot come to agreement on a deal. And this is, listen, this has been the Bengals' MO. I know they paid Joe Burrow and Chase and Higgins, but to me, like, they have to sort this situation out. Their defense is in no position to lose Trey Hendrickson. Like, that is crazy. But it's going to be a lot to go and get him. If you're a team like Detroit, to me, I would be calling Cincinnati immediately. You have to go in now. Maybe Washington, teams like that. I heard New England were linked to him as well. And there's still nothing clear with TJ Watt as well. So imagine two key pass rushers in the AFC North getting dealt. That'd be quite something. So this is a report from one analyst. He says it seems inevitable that he's going to get traded. They're still trying to work on a deal, but they're far apart at the minute. So we shall see what happens there. The other big news we want to mention was the 49ers, one of their star wide receivers, Juwan Jennings, is asked for a new deal. And if he does not get that new deal, he wants out. And this is the second year in a row that's happening like this. We had Brandon Ayuk last year, and trust me, they regret giving him that deal. Not saying Brandon Ayuk can't play, but they had huge offers from New England, big offers from the Steelers, and then they were getting nothing. They were getting absolutely nothing. And the 49ers said no, and then these teams kept calling and kept going, fine, we'll up our offer, we'll up the offer, we'll up the offer. And they had agreements with New England, I believe, for compensation, and then Ayuk said, well, I'm not signing there, so the deal ain't going through. And then Pittsburgh, I think, had a deal in place as well, and he said, I'm not signing there either. And he came back to the table and said, all right, I'll take this deal. And that's happened to Brandon Ayuk. The 49ers caved and gave him a deal, 4 years, $120 million last year. Now, Juwan Jennings, who's been so productive for the 49ers, even in that Super Bowl 2 years ago, he was maybe their best player. He had breakout games last year as well. He's a hell of a player. He wants a new deal. Now, he's not going to probably ask for that Brandon Ayuk deal, but he definitely wants a pay increase. He's only going to make $7.5 million this year. So I understand him. He's 28 years old. He needs to get that big payday, and he's looking for it. And I understand it, but we're getting closer and closer to the training camp, and that Brandon Ayuk fiasco just went all the way into training camp last year, and then Ayuk got hurt. It was a whole mess for the 49ers, and now it's a very similar situation here between them and Juwan Jennings. Let's see what happens. I trust the 49ers. They've given out a lot of money this offseason. The biggest pay increase obviously came from Brock Purdy, who was making basically league minimum money as Mr. Irrelevant, to getting an absolutely huge $200-something million contract. Not to mention George Kittle and Fred Warner got new deals. Then you're going to have Bosa in a few years wanting to get a new deal. So the 49ers really have to be smart with this money. They already let Deebo Samuel go. They parted for him. They traded him to Washington. But they can't really afford to let Juwan Jennings go. We don't know what Ayuk's going to be coming off the ACL injury. Ricky Pearsall was really, really up and down. Understandably, he got shot in training camp or preseason, and he worked his way to get back. So they hope he can really hit his stride this year. And outside of that, Juwan Jennings is their go-to guy. George Kittle and Juwan Jennings. So they would really like to get this situation sorted out rather quickly. The 49ers, though, the one thing we've mentioned on this show before, what they have going for them is that schedule is quite easy this year. A lot of people think they're going to fall back because they have to pay guys, their team's getting older. But if you look at the schedule, they have a lot of winnable games. Yes, they have their two games against the Rams. They have their two games against the Cardinals. Their two games against the Seahawks. Fair enough. But they have the Saints. They have the Jaguars. They have Atlanta. They have the Giants. They have the Browns. They have the Panthers, the Titans, the Colts, the Bears. It is not a hard schedule at all. There's no Kansas City's on there. There's no Buffalo's. There's no Philadelphia's. There's no Washington's. There's no Lions. This is a cakewalk of a schedule for NFL standards in 2025. So they still have a good offensive line. Trent Williams is still there. Purdy should be healthy. McCaffrey should be healthy. They still have Juwan Jennings now. They still have Kittle. Ayuk's back. They expect Pearsall to make a jump. They have Robert Saleh as the defensive coordinator. That secondary is young, which is worrisome, but they still have Warner and Bosa. So to me, the 49ers going to be right there in a playoff race. I'm not saying they're going to win the NFC. I don't think they're as good as the Rams. They're not as good as Philadelphia. Are they as good as the Lions? Who knows? But that's the tier I see them in. Maybe in the Green Bay, Washington, Minnesota tier. That's where I would put them right now. But that schedule is so easy, they should be in the wild card chase. But that is not news you want to see if you're a 49ers fan. Because now you had Brandon Ayuk fiasco last year. He gets injured, and now you have Juwan Jennings wanting a big pay increase or a trade. That's not a good sign for the 49ers. But John Lynch and Shanahan, trust me, they're getting together, and they're trying to get that deal done. So thanks for joining us on this week of the Tommy John Show. We'll be back next Monday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on CJLO 1690 a.m. We'll recap the British Open, get some more NFL talk as training camp gets closer and closer, and we will look at the post All-Star break baseball standings. I'm Tommy Lane for the Tommy John Show. We'll be back next Monday. Thanks again for listening.
Hi, this is...